The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Coming up, Breadline Britain, the hidden poverty affecting millions in work. Families earning up to £40,000 are saying that they struggle to provide for their children. So where does that leave the government's flagship promise to make work pay? Meanwhile, the Prime Minister turns tax avoidance campaigner, but bypasses banking and big business and sets his aim instead on the distinctly murky world of comedy. Also this week, a new government in Greece, a new parliament in France, a squabble at the G20 and a new bailout on the horizon. Yep, it's just another week in the Eurozone and we'll bring you right up to date. Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian's esteemed columnists Jonathan Friedland and Polly Toynbee, as well as from the conservative think tank Policy Exchange, Matthew Oakley. A warm welcome to you all. Now, a Guardian survey this week found that more than half of teachers are regularly bringing in food to schools for children who would otherwise go hungry. The Guardian's Amelia Gentleman went down to one local school which runs a subsidised breakfast club to speak to pupils and teachers.
Breakfast club starts at 8 o'clock, yeah. Normally, if I never went to breakfast club, I'll just probably be coming to school late. But I have something to look forward to in the morning.
You don't have anything for breakfast in the morning. How does it make you feel by lunchtime?
Grumpy.
Sometimes your belly starts to rumble and you focus on your belly, but you don't focus on the work that much.
Tired, stressed.
Breakfast club is really important because in a lot of cases we find children haven't had anything since the previous day's school lunch. More children seem to be saying they're hungry than we've ever had before.
If I have money, I just go to McDonald's.
I think it's difficult for a lot of our parents to understand that there's more benefit to going to the supermarket and buying, for example, a loaf of bread and making toast in the morning than giving your child 50p and saying buy a packet of crisps. Some families who send their children to breakfast club for childcare because they are working, but they're often working in the service industries, the hotels, and those jobs are precarious. I know there's cynicism, and it's difficult to say why these children are hungry, but it's just the money runs out.
Amelia Gentleman there, reporting for The Guardian series this week on Breadline Britain. Now, Polly Toynbee, until now, an awful lot of the rhetoric, the debate around poverty has very much been around people who are out of work and need to get into work. And of course, there's still a lot of those. But what this series has tried to do is shine a light on people who are working but still poor.
Quite right too, because it's been the case for many decades now that the majority of people living below the poverty line are actually in work. And yet the caricature of them, every time that Chris Grayling or Ian Duncan Smith talks about the poor, it's always about them being lazy and having to be chivvied into work. And whenever you say to them, but what about the fact that most people are in work already and are still poor and can't earn enough to support their families, they simply blank you out. They say nothing, they turn away and are back talking about scroungers and the rest of it. I think this series really emphasises the true story about the state of the British economy, which is of grotesque inequality and it being very difficult to solve, because in a time of high unemployment, can you push up wages to a living wage? If you don't, then you have to subsidise them with tax credits. Well, the government's cutting tax credits. This is a real conundrum.
Matthew, it's certainly been around as an issue. People talk about it, the hardness of balancing budgets for people who are working. But this week, Ian Duncan Smith's favourite think tank, the Centre for Social Justice, its new boss told The Guardian until recently they'd missed working poverty. Before we get onto the solutions, would you accept the government's missed this issue as well?
I don't think so. I think this government and the last government did care a lot about in-work poverty. You know, you look at what the last government did with tax credits, huge redistribution to people in work with tax credits. And the same will be true with universal credit when that comes in. In fact, you'll be getting more money to people right at the bottom of the income distribution, but in work through universal credit, and also improving take-up for those people of benefits. But I think perhaps we need to look at the stats a little bit closer and actually look at, you know, there's Polly was saying about, you know, most people who are in poverty or classified as being in poverty are actually in work. Now, partly that's to do with the numbers involved here. Mm-hmm. So there's more people in work than there are out of work. Mm-hmm. And so if you take, you know, a small percentage of those people who are in work, that looks like quite a big number compared to a big percentage of those people in poverty who are out of work. So, you know, if you just look at, you know, the recent DWP release has shown that I think only 3% of families who've got two earners in work are in poverty. Now that compares to something like more like, you know, 13% of people in poverty for people who are out of work. You know, so there's, you know, quite a big difference here. So just saying there's more people in poverty who are in work is perhaps missing the point slightly. And, you know, I think that's why there's been this big kind of focus, is because, you know, there's this really high proportion of people who are out of work or in poverty.
Okay, but Jonathan, there's even if there's a lot of, you know, even if it's a low proportion of a big number, there's still a lot of them out there. And of course, it's very difficult for the government, any government just now, unless there's public money around, to know quite what to do about working poverty, isn't it? I mean,
I think so. I think it breaks what was a kind of easy paradigm, if you like, or an easy framework in which to understand this problem, which is that once you're in work, everything's fine, and then it's the people at the bottom who you then either help or blame in some of the
ways. According to taste.
Yes, according to... and that makes it quite simple, and it is very simplistic, and it's politically fraught for the government, I think, and there is an opportunity there for Labour. Labour always made such a thing about work as the panacea, really. Gordon Brown obsessed by work and the work ethic, and Matthew's absolutely right. He would then top up, you know, income for people at the very bottom who are working through credits, etc. But the idea was that work is the solution. And this then forces all politicians onto the back foot, really, because they now have to say, well, what else are they going to do? They have to do more, maybe the living wage, an increase in the minimum wage, that kind of thing. But the reason why it's an opportunity, I think, both a threat and an opportunity for Labour, is that Labour's own polling shows that they are seen as still the party of the scroungers, the layabouts, the people who don't work, etc. All kinds of focus grouping says that, and that's language, obviously, they, you know, I wouldn't endorse or use, but that's the kind of language that comes back at them. And this is a way for them to say, look, we're not on. When we're doing things for poverty, it doesn't mean we're on the side of people who are not putting something in. We're on the side of people who really are, to use the old cliche, hardworking families. So they can redefine that, but I agree, it throws the coalition and really everyone else onto, you know, back against the wall, because they now have to think of answers other than the old stock ones.
And in a way, Polly, yesterday's unemployment figures, which went under the radar, partly because they were really so surprisingly good, but this does show that you don't solve the poverty problem just by containing the unemployment problem, if indeed we're able to do that. Still a big if.
The unemployment figures were astonishing, very good. And if you ask people at the OBR, the Office of Budget Responsibility, they're completely perplexed and bamboozled by it too. Nobody quite knows how it is in this recession that we haven't got much higher unemployment. Totally good thing we haven't. There's been a lot of holding on to people with skills, a lot of people who've been willing to take pay freezes rather than lose jobs in their workplaces. But the predictions I see today are that over the summer, that's likely to fall again. This may just be a temporary blip. I hope not. The good thing about these figures, too, is that there were some new full-time jobs, because the last lot of figures, all of the increase, every single extra job was all part-time. And, of course, that contributes to the working poverty, people who cannot get more hours, which has been made much worse by the government's new rule saying that couples who can't get over 24 hours of work have take a £4,000 a year hit in their tax credits, which is really cruel at a time when so many part-time workers are frantically looking for extra hours anyway.
And that question of not so much the unemployed but the underemployed, Matthew, is just becoming more and more urgent, isn't it?
No, absolutely. I think what I'd say is actually, you know, perhaps looking at this kind of short-term stuff around the recession and unemployment now is perhaps, again, missing the point. It's, you know, this is a, you know, the in-work poverty and you know, median incomes being quite slow to grow is a phenomenon we've seen for, you know, decades now. And so I think you're right that actually there needs to be quite different thinking about how we tackle some of these things. I know.
And do any of us have any ideas? Because this is now one of those stylized facts everyone observes, that the people in the middle income-wise have been stuck now for a decade, even for 3 decades in America, while economy boom. And Johnny says maybe you could increase the minimum wage, but it's hard to increase without limit, isn't it?
Even then, if you're talking about needing £41,000 for a family with two children to not be officially in poverty, the living wage or the minimum wage increasing, that's not going to get you anywhere near that. It's, you know, you're a long, long way short of that. And so trying to think about ways which aren't just kind of trying to put more costs on firms without actually giving them the returns for that. So, you know,
you could link it, couldn't you? I'm just being slightly playful here, but you could link it with Vince Cable's proposals on high executive pay this week. And you could say, here's the ceiling percentage wise on increases or whatever that you're going to place or demand that shareholders place on management. And all the rest that would have gone to the top management will now have to be shared out among the other people who work in the company so that their pay goes up just as executive pay comes more into line with reality. You could, for example, have a go at that.
I think we should look at, when you 41,000 sounds a lot for a couple with two children. And the real reason for that is such a very, very large amount of that will be going on rent or housing or maybe mortgage, perhaps not at that level now if they're young couples, where home ownership is falling drastically and people really want to be homeowners and rents are astronomical because of the failure of successive governments to build. And this government only built 15,000 houses last year, which is the lowest ever. Desperate need for housing. And if the price of housing could come down, that's another way of looking at how people's incomes could increase. But of course, with cuts in housing benefit and cuts in, quite drastic cuts in council tax benefit, people are going to find themselves squeezed on that side too. Rents rising much faster than people's wages. I think a real assault, if Labour really took up a kind of build policy, that's one way which you can begin to see incomes easing.
As well as solving this problem, another thing that you might try and do politically is to shuffle the goalposts around, which is something we've heard something about this week. Obviously, how one defines what it is to be poor is very, very controversial. Matthew, what do you make of what we've been hearing from Ian Duncan Smith about rewriting the poverty definition?
It's something you've heard from Policy Exchange in the past before as well. So, you know, I'm broadly supportive. I think, you know, I've read some of the things that Polly's saying, and I kind of understand the criticism that she's been saying. But I think, actually, it's about realising that the current measure is, or the current desire for the measure is about two things. One is poverty, and one is about life chances. And we're currently putting those two things in the same bag and assuming that, you know, we can throw one policy lever at two goals. And that's clearly not been working. So what I'd be very much in favour of is, you know, looking at poverty, looking at to see what you can do with redistribution, and then looking aside from that, looking to see what you can do to increase the life chances of people, whether they be low income, medium income, middle income, or even high income people, and seeing what we can do to make sure that life chances are boosted as well. And that clearly isn't just about redistribution; that's about all the other things we need to do around, you know, incentivising work. It's about the school system.
Does it require you to change what criteria someone has to fulfil to be counted as poor?
That's an interesting question. I mean,
do you think someone's poor if they're too far behind the middle, which is what one of the official statistics?
No, absolutely. I think obviously that coincides with a very certain view of what poverty is, and I don't, you know, let's not go into the kind of absolute versus relative poverty debate. That's fine as a measure. I think it's perfectly relevant, but the problem is that it really influences what people in Whitehall, what people in the Treasury, what people in the Department for Work and Pensions do. And so they've got a choice over how to spend their money when they're raising money from tax revenues. They've got a choice of what to do. And at the moment, the current system, you know, I've experienced from working in the Treasury, it just incentivises all the money to go into benefits for children in or out of work. And that doesn't incentivise work. It doesn't incentivise or even try and tackle at all this kind of life chances stuff that I'm talking about.
I always feel there are kind of two discussions about poverty. There is this one that happens in sort of Whitehall and in think tanks, and it uses languages like Gini coefficient and poverty and relative and absolute, etc., that is among the sort of policy community. And then there is the rest of everybody else who, and this is why this week's Guardian, and it's in that area rather, this week's Guardian series is so profound and important, because they will get the idea of teachers having to give food to children because they arrive at school hungry. They'll understand that. They'll also understand the idea that, okay, poverty isn't just people who are scroungers and thereabouts. It's also people who are working hard, playing by the rules, every other cliche. And that basic sort of quite gut understanding, free of all the policy jargon, will punch home. And it will finally give, I think, some definition to Ed Miliband's until now previously quite sort of flabby category of the squeezed middle. Now people will understand what he was talking about. There was a problem. The category was too broad. Now people will get this quite a simple idea that this Breadline Britain series nails, which is there are people who should be, by any normal definition, sort of in the middle. They're working, they've got a job, they did everything society told them to do, and they still can't feed their children properly. They're still hungry when they go to school. That, I think, has real political bite.
And do you think, Polly, though, it will have resonance? You know, when you have stories like we had in The Guardian this week about someone who's got a full-time job with a kid and then they're very, very stretched financially because they're saving up for Christmas and they're getting guitar lessons for their children. Do you think people will react warmly to that and say, we need to do something about the squeeze middle? Or do you think people will say, oh, it's hard for everyone at the moment and who needs guitar lessons anyway?
I think people do get what poverty is, because when there's always been a measure that's run alongside the mathematical measure, which at the moment happens to be particularly peculiar because in a recession poverty looks as if it's getting better, which is an odd anomaly we didn't really worry about. But when people are asked, what do you think are the minimum standards that a family bringing up children should have? And they add in things like two pairs of shoes and a winter coat and a week's holiday a year. And these tend to rise as living standards rise. They are more or less in line with what the poverty threshold actually is. And I think if people know how many children can never have a birthday party and can't even go to somebody else's because they can't afford to buy a present to bring, can never have anyone round for tea because they don't have any biscuits or anything to offer anyone for tea or spare food, those things become very real. And then I think increasingly, you know, they hear about the Trussell Trust opening up 2 food banks a week, more, I think, at the moment. And you go along to see the people there, and they are very ordinary people, quite often with jobs, who just run out of food at the end of the week. And, you know, they're not extravagant, and they're not smoking and drinking and all the rest of it. I think this gets through to people, because everybody knows enough people in their family who maybe need some help, maybe need some help with the shopping each week, and they see what's happening.
Jonathan, Gordon Brown invested a great deal of political capital in trying to use this language of child poverty to justify something that maybe he'd always wanted to do but never quite dared say he wanted to do, which is redistribute from poor people, from rich people to poor people. Child poverty and pensioner poverty, who could be against that? But when you see this week Ian Duncan Smith saying he's going to redefine what those things mean, do you think that really that tack in the end worked or not? Hasn't produced a durable settlement?
Well, I think that what Gordon Brown didn't bargain for, in a way, or what that whole idea and that emphasis on children and others was made for, was an era free of this great recession. I mean, that was the language he used in the good times, because he thought that people were flush, and they therefore that was the way to persuade them that they had money in their pocket. This is broadly the idea, and therefore they would be sympathetic to not helping, you know, the people who are, etc., layabouts, not putting them or in. But children, okay, as you said, who can be against helping them? That was not a language or a kind of set of tools that was prepared for the economic climate we're in now, where people are thinking, I've got enough to do looking after myself. And so it requires much more sort of push to do that. And I think there is therefore an opening for Ian Duncan Smith to sort of, to tighten up, because people are feeling less generous because they've got their worries about themselves or the people next door, as Polly says, in their own family.
On the other hand, people are so suspicious of politicians that when they hear Ian Duncan Smith, who looks, you know, more and more shifty these days, his halo has slipped a lot, saying, I'm going to move the goalposts, even if you don't really understand the technical details of the goalposts, everybody goes, oh, yes. I mean, I think people get it. You can't do that. And in fact, it won't happen because the ONS will go on collecting the same figures. But every time he says that, he sounds like a politician being very shifty.
I completely agree with the with your take on that, Polly. But personally, I think that this isn't just about the recession. It's not just about trying to save money. This is about actually trying to tackle head on some of the larger issues than just money. And in a world where, you know, we've got to prioritise where we put government resources, it seems right that you put the money where it's going to make most impact on people's lives. And I think what the coalition is saying is that actually they don't necessarily think that cash transfers, regardless of whether someone's in or out of work, is the way to make the most out of their long-term lives. And just I want to go back to kind of a previous conversation we're having around what people in the street think about poverty. So Policy Exchange actually did a survey last year on this and asked people what they thought poverty in Britain meant today. And 70% thought it was about not having a place to live, enough to eat or live on. 70%, so that's very much about getting by, about the weekly shopping. It's not necessarily about these kind of extra guitar lessons, which, you know, personally, I think has to be factored into what we're trying to achieve.
Yeah, but live on is quite an interesting phrase there. Yeah. Live on may well include the things that Polly was talking about two pairs of shoes and a winter coat. If you can't afford a coat for your child, you haven't got enough to live on.
No, absolutely. I think, again, it's about splitting out what we think is really what really is poverty, which I'd say is probably more to do with material deprivation, and what we want to do about social inclusion and about social mobility, which is very, very different sorts of policies.
Okay, I'm going to ask Polly to resist the temptation to come in and continue that particular argument and just say, could you help us, Polly, with breaking news today about what's going on in schools policy? It sounds like Michael Gove wants to get rid of GCSEs that the Conservative government's introduced in the 1980s, move back to O-levels, possibly rip up the national curriculum too. Do you think that's sort of about the social mobility rather than the poverty story? What's going on there?
Well, I think it's hugely appealing to Tory backbenchers. Frankly, to be a little bit cynical, I think Michael Gove has positioned himself brilliantly in terms of if there's going to be another leadership bid at some point, Cameron loses the election, he'll be in a prime position. He's done remarkably well. He's done better than any other minister in absolutely establishing what he's for and making his policies happen, unlike Lansley and everybody and Ian Duncan-Smith and all the others falling all over the place with chaotic policies. So this is very crisp. O-levels. Oh, we all remember O-levels. Most of the people who vote, you know, took O-levels because we're all older. What it means, we don't know because it's about the content. But it certainly rings every right political bell from his point of view. The content will be what matters. Doing away with the national curriculum is bizarre, but I imagine that the core subjects will remain. It puts the curriculum in his hands, I suspect, is what we're going to end up with. He's already being extraordinarily prescriptive. I love all the stuff about, you know, this is going to be the most decentralising government, certainly not in the education field.
And just one other bit of context in today's news, Johnny, in terms of how the squeezed middle are feeling right now. We've had David Cameron turning on tax dodgers.
Yes, again, sort of under pressure, more reactive. I mean, the point I was going to make about would agree with Polly. The thing that's exceptional about Michael Gove is that he's very often on the front foot. He is the one setting an agenda. So, for example, this with the O-levels, but even, you know, distributing copies of the King James Bible. He's on the front page for things he's doing rather than just often reacting. So this is something where, you know, this was in the news already about Jimmy Carr. David Cameron was asked for a comment. I don't know whether he would have wanted to comment on that otherwise. It was perhaps a bit awkward. And so he was pushed into that position. And that's just something you do see quite a lot where Cameron, I would say Osborne, certainly Lansley, the others are Theresa May, reacting and dealing with bad news, and Gove is sort of pushing forward, and it is quite a big difference.
And finally, Matthew, do you think the point about Cameron and the tax dodging, do you think he's just reacting, and if he is, do you think he's reacting to quite a deep thing in the public mood? You know, this used to be a rather special interest, kind of the Guardian tax gap series 3 years ago, rather worthy kind of subject. Do you think it's got a wider resonance now?
No, absolutely. I think now what we're seeing at the moment is the general public not willing to take people at the bottom who are seen not to be doing all they can to get back to work, for instance, and people at the top. So huge payouts for CEOs who aren't necessarily performing. And I think tax avoidance, tax evasion, whichever one it ends up being, the public don't take a very good view of that at the moment because they see everyone is feeling the squeeze, as you know we've been talking about here, and they want everyone else to be pitching in and trying to sort the situation out.
Well, we're feeling the squeeze of time ourselves just now, so we're going to draw that discussion to a close and say thank you very much. You can follow the rest of the reporting from the Breadline Britain series at guardian.co.uk. Now, tomorrow night, as Angela Merkel takes her seat at the European Football Championship to watch Germany take on Greece, headlines will no doubt write themselves. It's fair to say it's been another odd week in Europe, one that began on Sunday with the Greek elections and was followed by a less than harmonious week for many leaders at the G20 conference in Mexico. To attempt to try and put all the moving chaos into perspective, we're now joined by our Guardian Europe editor Ian Traynor. Let's just start with Greece, where of course we had what was billed as the continent's make or break election last Sunday. Could you just remind us what happened?
Oh, giant sighs of relief all round when the upstart radical left, led by Alexis Tsipras, failed to win the election. And we already have, things have been moving quite fast, election on Sunday, and a government formed by Wednesday. That's record timing for, that's a time record for the Greeks, of course, for Greek politics, showing the kind of pressure that they're under. Basically, a conservative-led, vaguely or broadly pro-EU and pro-bailout government under Antonis Samaras, and that has brought huge relief across the rest of Europe, and it looks as though the bailout plans are back on track after having been stuck for a couple of months.
And yet, the New Democracy Party came in with 29% or something of the vote, 4 points down on a very desperate showing it had in 2009. And on the same night, we had French win for the Socialists. So although you've got this kind of win on the technicalities for the austerity and the bailout, it also feels like the voters across the continent are going the other way at the same time.
Well, not so fast, Lord Copper. Great victory for François Hollande, an absolute parliamentary majority, bolstering him following his presidential victory in May. No doubt about that. PASOK, the mainstream centre-left social democrats in Greece, took an absolute hammering. They're in this new, they're a junior partner in this new coalition government, but of course, that's the mainstream left in Greece, and they're down on their knees at around 12-13%.
I mean, right.
So it was basically a protest vote. The real challenge here was coming from these new young radical upstarts in this coalition of kind of hard left and green, different green movements in Greece.
But I mean, with the Greek system, the winner gets this big top up, don't they? Otherwise, the difference between the radical left and the right would have been very small.
Yeah, indeed, it was. It was very narrow. Well, it was about between 2 and 3 points. The margin of victory. Extraordinary performance from Tsipras. I mean, these were guys who just a few years ago were at 4%, and they're now up at in the election in May that had to be rerun, they were at 17%, and now they're at 27%. I mean, it's meteoric.
Meanwhile, in Spain, we hear whispers of some kind of a deal, but they're not being confirmed yet.
Well, Spain's really the elephant in the room here. It's rather superseded Greece, in fact, because for obvious reasons. You know, it's a country of 40 million as opposed to a country of 10, 11 million. And at the G20 summit in Mexico, in fact, as a senior official here in Brussels who was attending that summit was telling me, basically, everybody thought they were discussing Greece, but in fact, everybody only wanted to talk about Spain. Now, Spain, a couple of weeks ago, rather symbolically requested help for its banks, and there's agreement on 100 billion bank recapitalization bailout for the Spanish banks, but politically it's very difficult for Rajoy. It still hasn't been formally requested. That might actually come today from the Spanish finance minister later today at a meeting of Eurozone finance ministers in Luxembourg, which will be grappling with all of these issues today, in fact, in Luxembourg. Quite an important meeting. You'll have the Greek stuff, you'll have the Spanish stuff, and you'll basically have broader policy issues of what the hell are we going to do about the euro.
And if we do get that plea for help, that Mayday call from Rajoy, the Spanish Prime Minister, will that be met with understanding or are things very fractious within Europe?
No, it's already basically been approved in principle, but there's the devil's in the detail with these things, and it won't happen immediately. Basically, it gets complicated. Basically, you have a temporary bailout fund at the moment, and you have a permanent eurozone bailout fund that is supposed to come into operation in July. Now, both these funds operate under different legal regimes. So basically, Eurozone governments would rather use the permanent thing that's coming in July, but it might not be up and running in time. So what we're going to see with Rajoy is sort of several weeks of drawn-out negotiations about on the conditionality, on how what Spain has to do to get the money. And that will form a so-called memorandum of understanding, and it'll probably be mid-July before that is signed. But there's no sense that they need the money right away. I mean, it's bank recapitalization rather than, you know, a sovereign debt issue with Spain. Bankia, one of the big troubled banks there, may need rather prompt assistance, but as for the rest of the banking sector in Spain, they're a bit more relaxed about getting the money to them fast enough.
Well, if there's time in principle to agree some of these things within Europe, if we now turn to Europe vis-a-vis the rest of the world, as you've been watching in Mexico, does it seem like Europe's fed up with the rest of the world telling it to sort out its problems? Is there now a Europe versus, I don't know, America and Japan and everyone else sort of spat brewing?
Well, there's an element of that. I mean, certainly the President Barroso of the Commission at his press conference in Mexico the other night was having a go at what he obviously perceived as some kind of provocative questions from the North American papers. Having said that, what the European Commission President has to say on this particular financial and debt sovereign debt crisis is really not creating policy, I'm afraid. For that, you have to listen to the President of France and more particularly the Chancellor of Germany. I mean, they're the effective leaders, and it's their money, and it's their taxpayers, and it's their budgets. It's not the European Commission's money. So, but clearly, you know, the Germans in particular, Merkel is the main kind of perceived to be the main block to any quick fix to the euro crisis, because it's, you know, it's all got to do with the Germans opening their checkbooks or lending their credit cards or whatever. Clearly, very strong pressure from the Obama administration on Merkel, less discreet from the British, which has become the kind of pattern, the habit. George Osborne and David Cameron have got into the habit of kind of lecturing the Europeans rather publicly on what they should be doing, and it's not particularly listened to with great satisfaction in European capitals, but there you go. The Americans a bit quieter, but much more forceful, leaning on Merkel to try and agree to stuff like radical stuff like euro bonds. In other words, pooling eurozone debt. The Germans are just not going to go there anytime soon. I mean, they're not ruling it out, but it's going to take years. And once they've got a new system in place that reassures the markets, that stabilizes the currency, and that lots of new control mechanisms that the Germans are actually satisfied that the system is working, they might take that step towards so-called mutualization of debt, but very little chance of it happening anytime soon.
And very quickly and very finally, who would you put your money on in the football tomorrow, Germany or Greece?
I'd put my money on Germany to win the tournament, I think, frankly.
So there we go, all bets on Germany once again as we draw Politics Weekly to a close. My thanks to Jonathan Friedland, to Polly Toynbee and Matthew Oakley, as well as to Ian Traynor, who we've just been hearing from there. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.